What is the meaning of renormalization, and in particular of this renormalization skills, scale we had to introduce? So I will remind what is what renormalization and the renormalization scale mean. Second, I shall discuss what are the consequences of this renormalization for scale invariance, which is another important point, and I will introduce what is called the scale anomaly. We shall see that, in fact, the fact that the theory gets renormalized, that the coupling constant depends on the energy scales, means that the scale invariance is, in some sense, spoiled by quantum effects. And the scale invariance of the classical theory is, in fact, modified by the quantum effects. And the third point I want to treat is to go back a little bit more on a more general ground on why. Why does it work? Why does it work, after all? And in connection with the short distance properties of the quantum field theory. So I will try to show that there is a connection between renormalization and a very important property of quantum field theory at short distances, which is called the operator product expansion. Okay. So depending on the time, I will discuss that just in a very sketchy way, or I will give a few more details. Okay, that's for today. And tomorrow, so that's for today. And tomorrow, I will rediscuss renormalization from another point of view, which is in some sense an alternate way to discuss renormalization, which is called the Wilsonian renormalization. Which is now the modern way to treat renormalization problem, why renormalization works in quantum field theory, and also what is the connection between renormalization problem in quantum field theory and problems that you have been discussing in the statistical mechanical course, critical phenomena. Okay, so let us go back to what we did yesterday. Yesterday, we have seen that for the 5-4 theory, in order to construct at one loop a consistent finite theory free of ultraviolet divergences, we have to perform a renormalization, both of the mass and of the coupling constant. And what does it mean? Renormalization means that we have first to specify the energy, or if you want, the momentum scale, which I denoted mu, at this scale, the so-called renormalized coupling constant which I call GR is defined. Okay? Because the renormalized coupling constant is extracted from the value of some, for instance, four-point function in the theory at some fixed energy scale. You have to specify what is the scale, what is the energy of the incoming momenta of the particles which in the process which correspond to this four particle correlation function in the theoretical calculation. Okay, so you have to specify the energy momentum scale because it's implicit. If you do not do it in a calculation, if you say, oh, it's one, you say, okay, but is it one EEV? Is it one MEV? Is it one GEV? So it's implicit. In any calculation in quantum theory, you implicitly are specifying the energy scale at which you are working. It's also a length scale, so it can be, are you working at a length scale which is the size of your laboratory? Is it at the size of an atom? It is at the size of the solar system. So it's implicit in any kind of physics you are doing. So that's something important. And once you have done that, you see that, if you want to work with a theory which is specified by this energy momentum scale mu, by the renormalized coupling constant G and by a renormalized mass, which I will be taken to be such that the physical mass is equal to zero, to simplify, then we have seen that in order to define, to construct such a theory, in fact, you should not start from, for instance, a functional integral using an action which is given by just by those parameters, but you have to, at the level of the quantization, you have to construct a functional integral where you specify what is an ultraviolet cutoff in order for the momenta, for the calculation to make sense. And for instance, I took a sharp momentum cutoff, which means that in my calculation, all the momenta in the propagator, in the calculation, are less than this ultraviolet cutoff scale lambda. You see, but at the end, we get rid of this lambda, but it's an intermediate step in the calculation. And of course, lambda has to be much larger than the renormalization scale mu, of course. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. And you have to work with a renormalized action, which is different from the naive action you would be using if you want to do classical mechanics. You have to use the renormalized action, S renormalized of the quantum field phi, okay, which is of the same form than the ordinary phi 4 theory, except that, so it is of this following form, it is d4x. There is a 1/2 d mu phi squared plus. But then you have to introduce a mass term, although the theory is massless here. So it's a massless theory. And you have to introduce a coupling constant, phi 4, which is different from the renormalized coupling constant simply because there are radiative corrections, quantum corrections. And if you start to quantize a theory with this coupling constant, the coupling constant you measure at scales mu is different because you have to take into account the quantum effects. Okay, so those are the bare parameter, if you want. Those are called the bare parameter or couplings of the theory. And these are the renormalized couplings, the things which are connected to what you are measuring at scale mu in experiments. Okay? And we have seen that in order to have the connection, in fact, the relation between GR and G has to contain some logarithm of this big scale because there are ultraviolet singularities in the calculation. And the result was, if I remember well, that G R was defined as a function of G as, if I don't find back, I will definitely make a sign mistake. So this is that G R has to be defined as, of course, is G. And then there is a, where is it? Okay, let us do it in the other way. This is then you have a minus 3/2, 3/2, 1/4 pi squared. It's a numerical factor which comes from the integral, and then there is a logarithm of lambda over mu squared. Okay, and we have seen that in the same way. So you can invert that by saying that at one loop, G equal GR plus, and of course, I'm sorry, there is a GR squared minus G squared plus 3/2 of plus GR squared, 3/2 of 1/4 pi squared log of lambda over mu squared. And in the same way, we have seen that the mass term should not be zero, but it should be given by minus gr 1/2 1 over 4 pi squared. And then you have a lambda squared. This is the mass. Okay.
Is this,
yes?
This is an expansion in G, right? On the left-hand side, orders in G?
This is both an expansion in G and in gr. Here it's an expansion in G. Here it's an expansion on gr, but you see that at leading order, g is the same order on, than gr.
Weren't we going to send g, though, to, isn't the bare mass, the bare coupling constant get sent to infinity? Doesn't it end up diverging?
Yeah, that's, at that level, we are doing, you are right. You must be very, very careful of what you are doing when you send one of the coupling constants when zero, and in addition, when lambda, in fact, because remember, lambda is very large, and we are doing an expansion in the coupling constant, so the coupling constant is very small. And when you are doing that, you may say, okay, but this is very small, but this is very large. Is this small or is it large? It's a non-trivial question. And the real answer to this question is obtained by considering Wilsonian normalization group, where you can address non-perturbative questions. At the moment, I will always assume that what's the most important is the coupling constant. So I keep lambda fixed, and then I let G and GR goes to zero. Okay. So it's an expansion both in G or in GR. Okay. So I know another way to think about it, which is a bit more satisfying, is that we are doing a loop expansion. We are doing an expansion in H bar by considering the loop expansion. Okay. So everywhere here, this term is a classical term. This term is a term coming from the one loop diagram. So there is an H bar implicit that I set to one. So in my calculation, I set H bar to one because for simplicity. But here there is an H bar. Here there is an H bar. And the next term will be of order h bar squared. So if you think about it in terms of writing renormalized coupling, bare couplings in a loop expansion, then you are safe at the level of the mathematics. Okay? Yes?
In order to study
a theory
without mass,
yes?
You start with a better action that contains mass.
Yes.
Why don't you put many more bare in that direction? Why is it enough to consider
so what kind of term do you want to add?
I don't know what they are, but you decided that even if you want to study a mathematics theory,
yes,
you have to start with a theory.
Well, okay. An answer is that in order to study a massless theory, you have to introduce a mass. That's because that's a simplest solution. If you don't introduce a mass, you don't get a massless theory. So then, what do you want to introduce? You can introduce a phi 6 operator, some higher dimensional operator, but it makes, first, it's not very natural. It causes a lot of problems. And I will see when discussing Wilsonian normalization tomorrow that it doesn't work
right.
Either.
I'm sure there's a justification for that.
Yes.
But with the information we have so
yes.
far, it's not clear to me.
Why okay, would it's. Okay, I see what you mean.
Okay.
So take it as the simplest solution, and it's quite natural because it's natural to have a mass term in a theory. And I hope I will answer your question in a more satisfactory way tomorrow. Okay, so we have seen that this is the relation between the bare mass, the mass you put in the action, which has to be introduced in the functional integral, and the renormalized mass, and the same, the relation, in order to have, if you want, you can state that you have a renormalized mass, which is equal to zero, if you want, and in order to have a renormalized mass to be equal to zero, here is the mass you have to put in the action, okay? So that's something I think, I hope is now clear. So now what, the very important thing is that in fact, shouldn't have behaved like that, yes. Oh, this was a real one, okay. So what, okay, I think it's better if I put the rear. Oh, no wave towards the rear. No, okay, no, okay. So now what is important is that the same theory, the same physical theory, in fact, is described by either some GR at some energy scale mu, or by some GR prime at some renormalization scale mu prime. Because simply, remember, the renormalized coupling constant corresponds to the measurement of some, for instance, scattering process at some energy mu. The particles have an energy mu, and you, then you get a result that after some theoretical calculation, you said, okay, from what I know on the theory, from the results of my measurement, I found that the value of the renormalized coupling is GR. Okay. Now, I made the same experiments with particles at an energy mu prime. I get another result, doesn't need to be necessarily the same. And from the calculation, I extract and I say, okay, the value of the renormalized coupling is G prime. But that's the same theory. We are sending the same particles, which interact in the same way, simply at different energies, okay? So this means simply that the same physical theory is described by different coupling constant at different energy. And that's the phenomenon that, in fact, you have running, what is called, the running coupling constants, okay? And this, the fact that the coupling constant depend on the scale, in fact, is encoded in a flow equation. That's what we flow show last time. What is this flow equation? It means that take the, for instance, the one simple way to derive this flow equation among many one is to consider that the same physical theory, in fact, with different GR and different mu, is in fact correspond to the same G and lambda. If you have a quantum theory which has which is defined at a very, very high energy level by a functional integral where there is an ultraviolet cutoff lambda and a given bare coupling constant G, okay, it's the same functional integral, so it's the same as the correlation function you extract from the calculation are the same at low energies, okay. So now you see immediately that simply, if you keep in this equation above here G equal GR plus GR squared, 3/2, etc., you can, for instance, assume that if I assume that G prime is mu plus some small variation, I make a small variation, and I assume that G prime R is GR plus some small variation of GR, okay? It's easy to assume that when I make this variation in this equation, since G is fixed, dG is equal to zero, okay, I keep G fixed. So G and lambda fixed. I don't change anything in the functional integral which defines my equation. So on the right hand, on the left hand side of the equation for G, dG is zero, and on the left, on the right hand side, I am changing both mu and I'm changing GR. So this is the sum over time, which is the variation of GR. What is the variation of GR? It's dGR times 1 plus 2 GR 3/2 of log lambda squared over mu squared, plus a term which is given by the variation of d mu. And since I have a log, it's a d mu 1 over mu. There is a factor minus 2, because that's the logarithm of 1 over mu squared. And I have a gr squared, 3 half of 1 over 4 pi squared. Okay? And from this calculation, you see immediately that dgr over d mu times mu, I replace here, is given by, I have a factor 2g, I have a factor 2gr, no, I have a 1. Here I have a Oh, so you see, this has to be equal to 0. So I see that mu dgr over d mu has to be equal to why is there a 3 half? Yes. Yes. I get, I'm sorry, I have 3 gr squared times 1 over 4 pi squared. Half plus these terms as a potential singularity, but it's of order gr cubed, so it's given by a higher order loop terms. Okay. So you see, here is the equation which tells me how gr of mu changes with the scale of mu. And this is by definition the beta function for the coupling constant. Yes?
So gr is a function of mu.
So now I consider here in this equation that gr, when I'm considering it at g and lambda fixed, is a function of mu. Okay? You see? But you see, in this equation, now this equation, the leading term, the first term here, doesn't depend on lambda. So you can set now lambda to infinity. Now I can set lambda to infinity, g to infinity, such that gr of mu is, and mu, gr and mu are fixed. And this equation is still valid. And that's the important point. Because now these equations tell me how gr of mu depends on mu, the physics has been fixed. You see? Okay. Okay. And we have seen that since the sign of this equation is positive here, it means that gr of mu goes to 0 as 1 over log of 1 over mu with a universal factor which is related to that when mu goes to 0. This means that the renormalized, the effective coupling constant of the theory, if you measure the strength of the interaction of the theory, you know, when you go to smaller and smaller energies, if you are looking at scattering of particles with lower and lower energy, the scattering is less important. So the effective interaction is less and less important. So this is denoted by the fact that the theory is ultraviolet free. It becomes non-interacting theory. I'm sorry, it's infrared free. It means that if you go to low energy, means weak interactions. Okay? Yes?
Why is the log of lambda times rho?
Pardon?
Why is the log of lambda squared times rho?
Why is it neglected, you mean? Oh, because it's a term of order gr squared. If I write that this is zero, I get that gr over d mu is given by this gr, and I put this on the denominator. But remember, I'm always doing an expansion in gr. So first I have a one, and then I have a term of order gr squared containing a log of lambda squared. So there is a potential divergence, but it's in a term we are neglecting anyway. And in fact, if you do the calculation taking into account the log of lambda, which come from the two loop diagrams, this cancels. So in fact, this term is also finite. Also finite. But you need to take into account the two loop diagram of the theory. So the calculation becomes more complicated. Okay? So the theory is said to be free in the infrared. Because the sign, and that's because the sign of the beta function is positive. Okay? Okay. So now, what does it mean for, the question is, what does this mean for scale invariance? Remember, we have seen that the classical massless five-four theory is scale invariant. And for a very, very simple reason. It's scale invariant because we have seen the dimension of the coupling constant is zero while the dimension of the field is one in terms of momentum scale. Okay? Now, this means in particular that if you make a scale transformation on your theory, the effective coupling constant doesn't change. So if you are doing a classical experiment, you know, if you are doing a classical scattering of particles in quantum, in the 5-4 theory, the only interaction is a point-like interaction given by the tree diagram. And then the strength is independent of, this is independent of the energy. If you have such a scattering process where you do not take into account quantum effects. Okay? Now, the results of the calculation means that in the quantum theory, in those process, you have quantum effects where you create a pair of particles which are then reabsorbed, annihilates, and make your outcoming states. So you have a radiative correction, and then it becomes dependent of the energy. You see? Okay? And of course, this means that, in fact, that scale invariance is not satisfied in the quantum theory. See, you have a classical theory which is invariant, and a quantum theory which is not invariant anymore. Yes? I explained that yesterday. Do you remember?
Yeah.
It just has this property that if you make a change, if you change any configuration phi of x into a phi lambda of x, which is defined by lambda times phi of lambda x, which corresponds to make a scale transformation. You scale the distance by some factor, and you scale the field accordingly to their dimension. And the factor here is lambda, because the dimension of the field is one. Which has?
Zero mass.
Pardon? Zero mass. Yes, yes. It's true only for the zero mass.
You identify like the normalized mass before.
Yeah, okay. So for the massless quantum theory, where massless means the renormalized mass is equal to zero. Yes. Okay. But this, be careful. This effect, in fact, is not due to the fact that you have renormalized the mass. It comes from the fact that you have renormalized the coupling constant. You see, it's very important. It comes from the coupling constant. Coupling constant. Renormalization. They are not directly related. They are not directly related because, for instance, there are many examples of physical theories where there is no direct relation. For instance, in quantum electrodynamics. Quantum electrodynamics, you have two fields instead of one. In quantum electrodynamics, well, let us write it here, in QED, you have the gauge field, the photon, the mu, the vector potential, and you have the field for the fermion, the fermionic field, the field for the electron and the positron, okay? Mu is massless in all cases because of gauge invariance, okay? Psi, the electron may have a mass or you can consider massless fermions. In the real world, fermions are not massless, but you may consider quantum electrodynamics with massless fermions, you see? And you can, for a reason that I will perhaps explain later, the fact that there is a coupling constant doesn't renormalize the mass by a lambda squared term. So there is a mass renormalization, but it's induced by, there is some log lambda m. So this means that if you start from m bare in quantum electrodynamics, if m bare, if you want, the mass you put in the functional integral that I will define later is equal to zero, then the renormalized mass stays zero, you see? So in some sense, it's different from what's going here. Okay.
I was asking this based on, I mean, if you have the Yukawa interaction.
Yes.
I know that the Yukawa interaction is enforced by the default.
Yes, but the Yukawa interaction are not renormalizable. So that's something different. Okay. So now, one last thing I want to say about this classical massless phi 4 is that the fact that the dimension G is zero is related to the fact that the theory is renormalizable. The theory is renormalizable because, for instance, consider, for some reason, consider the phi 4 theory in D equals 6 dimension. Assume that we live in a 6-dimensional space-time instead of a 4-dimensional space-time, okay? Well, for string theorists, it's not a big deal to assume that. But assume we are doing that. Then you can check very easily that the massless phi 4 theory in 4 dimensions is still scale invariance, but the dimension of the field is changed because the dimension of the field is then, instead of being 1, I think it's 2. Yes. And the dimension of the coupling constant G is minus 2, I think. Yes. And what does it mean? If you think about the normalization of the coupling constant, you see that if you consider the diagram like that, which now it's diverging like lambda squared. You see? Because you have a momentum 1 over k squared, a momentum 1 over k squared, but you have to integrate over d6k. So it's diverging, which is more serious. But in the phi 4 theory, in this case, these diagrams, remember, we consider, behaves like a log of lambda. because you have three propagators, so you have an integral with 1 over k squared to the power 3. This is k, where you compute the amplitude, the Feynman amplitude associated to this diagram. So, okay, so it has a log of lambda. So this means that in order to renormalize the theory, in the renormalized action, not only you need to add a lambda squared phi 4 terms, but you need to organize a log lambda phi 6 term. You see? So in order to have a phi 4 theory finite in 6 dimension, you need in the renormalized action to introduce a phi 6. And that's very problematic because this explodes, because at the next order, you need to add phi 8 term, etc. And you lose any control of the theory. So in that case, when the phi 4 theory in 6 dimension is said to be non-renormalizable. And this is related to the fact that the dimension of the coupling constant here is non-zero. If you do a bit of power counting of the dimensional analysis, in fact, it's because the dimension of the coupling constant is zero in 4 dimensions that you can only have counter terms which are in phi 4, but with logarithm of lambda, like above. You see? Okay, so it's a very important difference between phi 4 in 4 dimensions and phi 4 in 6 or 8 or 7 or 5 dimensions. Okay? Okay. Yes? Pardon?
Could you please mention again why we had to add this phi to the 6?
What?
Why we had to add this phi to the 6?
Because when I'm doing a one loop calculation, I get a divergence which is proportional to log lambda, but you know it's associated to an irreducible part of the diagram here with 6 extra legs. So in the same way that in 4 dimensions we had a log of lambda associated to this diagram with 4 legs, which can be absorbed in a phi 4 counter terms here, this divergence can be absorbed by a phi 6 counter term. You see? So that's the reason. Basically, you look at the divergence subdiagram, irreducible diagram, and you see how many legs they have, and it tells you how, what is the kind of operator of counter terms you have to introduce in your action. Okay. I thought this will become a bit more clear just now because what's going on? Oh. It seems a bit tired. So now I have only half an hour, but I still want to discuss something important which is related to those questions, which is the operator product expansion. So let us, after all, in perturbation theory, we're doing perturbation theory, and in perturbation theory, we are just computing, in fact, expectation value of operator. So we are computing expectation value of products of operators, phi, phi 4, etc., in the free theory. So let us come back to the free field theory. I consider the free field, so G is equal to 0. The only object which is interesting is the propagator between the 2 points X and Y. We know what it is. We know that it is d4k over 2 pi squared times ei kx minus y times k square. Let me consider the massless theory to simplify. And so for it's easy to see that we know that it's something, there is a number, it's a constant times x minus y to the power minus 2. Okay? I consider the free field theory, I'm going back to real space time. Okay? And in this theory, the question is, how can we define operators and products of operators in the free field theory? Because it's a question which seems very, very simple. We have assumed that it was possible, but if you think a little bit more about that, you discover that there will be some subtleties. So, first thing we want, is it possible to define the operator square of the field operator at a point here? Is it possible to define this operator? We know that there will be some problems simply because we know that in the free theory, the expectation value of the product of two operators at the same field is infinite because it's given by this diagram like that we have calculated, and we know it's infinite. Okay? Yes?
So when we consider composite operators,
yes,
do we always consider them inside some expectation value?
Yeah. So this means here I am considering the expectation value of phi squared of x expectation value, which means that this is a vacuum expectation value of just a single phi squared operator. And we saw that already for the vacuum expectation value of a single phi squared operator, it's infinite. So it means that the simplest matrix element, the phi squared operator, considered as an operator, has some problems. Okay? So, does it mean that it doesn't make any sense to consider what is a phi squared operator? No, because you have to be a little bit more careful. You have, let me consider now what's happening when I have two operators, phi at some point x and phi at some point y in spacetime. So if x and y are different, then it's I'm fine. This is a well-defined object. Okay? So now, let me consider that I want to compute some matrix element of this operator. Those are operators acting on the inverse space of the theory. I want to consider some matrix element of operator. So one simple way to construct those matrix elements is, in fact, to add to those operators other operators, phi of the one, phi of the n, and to compute the expectation value of such a product of operator. So in addition to x and y, I had an arbitrary number of n points in spacetime, you see. And the only requirement, of course, for this to be well defined, that x is different from y, and also x and y are far away from the point here. Okay? And if I know, so I'm considering the expectation value of those objects in the free theory. So we'll just add a note here, a zero, to specify that I'm always computing this in the free theory. Okay? And in fact, you can show that if you know all those matrix elements, you can, it means that you can reconstruct the operator out of the correlation functions.
See? What is the matrix element?
Ah, okay. So here I am using the notation which is valid, for instance, for Euclidean field theory. But remember, in quantum field theory, this corresponds to a time order product of operators. So let us say, let us imagine that in your space time, I have my time. This is time. I have my space. Here is, and consider that I have time ordered my operator. So this is, let us say, y. Here is x. And some of the z's are in the past. And some of the z's are somewhere in the future. I need just, perhaps I need a color with another color here. And some of these are in the future of those. Okay, this is not really in the future, but if this is a time vector, the operator commutes, so I don't have to care. So you see, I can write this. In that case, this object will correspond to a vacuum expectation value. This is the vacuum of the free theory. Okay, and we know that this corresponds to expectation value of time ordered products of operators. So I have two time ordered products of those operators. So this means that here first, I apply to the vacuum the phi operator which lies to the past of x and y. Then I have phi of y. Then I have phi of x. And then I have the product of operator, which lies in the future of x and y. Okay? But I can just write this. I can consider that this is an operator. This is a big state. Of the quantum field theory. This is a big state of the quantum field theory. And this is the operator I am interested in, phi of x, phi of y. You see? And in fact, you can, with a little bit of work, and I think, in fact, you have already been doing that implicitly, if not explicitly, in the quantum field theory one course using canonical quantization. In fact, you can construct all the states of the Fock space of the theory applying an arbitrary number of field operators on the vacuum of the theory. Okay? So what you must keep in mind is just that if you know all the correlation function of the operator, in fact, you know all the matrix elements of the operator here. You see? Okay. So now let us come back to this object and compute it in perturbation theory. It is given by a sum of pairings, a sum of pairings of phi. And to each pairing, you associate propagator between the points. Okay. So now, if you think a little bit about what's going on, this one works. I want to compute this, and let us say that simply I have a big object where I have many points. I have x, I have y, and I have all my z's. This is z1, this is zn. And I want to compute this big box, which means just this object, in terms of pairings of operator. So I can apply the Wick theorem. This is coming from the Wick theorem. And I have considered all the possible pairings between the x and y, and then to this will be associated the products of the associated propagators. And it's very easy to see that you have two kinds of pairings if I am interested in what is happening here when x goes to y. I am interested in what is happening when x goes to y because I want to see whether I can make sense of x squared of x, of phi squared of x. So I'm interested in what's happening when x goes to y. So x is close to y. So if x is close to y and far apart from all the other z's, then you have two very different pairings. You have the pairings where x is paired to y. And now all the other pairings are between the points Z1, Zn. Okay, and then you have the contribution where X is paired to one of the points here, and Y is paired to one of the points here. So it can it may be any of the points. I'm just summing over the contribution. So this is here. This is the sum of diagrams. This means here sum of all pairings. Here you see the pairings where X is paired with Y, and here X is not paired with Y. Okay? And now if you think about this, this is just proportional to phi of X, phi of Y, because this is a propagator, you see, times this is a contribution of the sum of all the pairings between Z1 and Z2. So this is just the same correlation function as this function, but simply you are removed the phi of X, phi of Y. So I can rewrite this as the expectation value of phi of Z1 up to phi of Zn. Expectation value in the free theory. And at the moment, I will do something which looks a bit like magic, but it doesn't cost anything. Let me rewrite the operator unity. Okay? The operator unity is an operator which do nothing, which on any states of the theory just leaves the state invariant. Okay? So I rewrite the unit operator here just for reasons which appear later, okay? So this is given by, this gives these terms. And this object is something which is which is finite. So this is, of course, singular. Singular when X goes to Y, because the propagator is singular. But nothing happens here when X goes to Y. You see, X can X and Y doesn't see each other because they interact only with the other Zs. So this is something which is regular, completely regular, when X goes to Y. Okay? And so it's something which is regular, and it's so I can just define an operator by stating, so I remember I was first computing phi of X, phi of Y, phi of Z1, phi of Zn. And I have decomposed it into a part which is singular when X goes to Y, and the part which is regular. Okay? Let me just call this part. So, but this part is regular, but it depends on X and Y. You see, this part doesn't depend on X and Y. This part depends only on X and Y and not on the Z's. And let me define this by definition. Let me write it as an object that I think you will recognize because you have seen it in N. So let me define this as the normal products of the field phi X and Y. And I think you don't see me, so I should go. Okay. So you see the contribution of all these sums, I call it just the expectation value of an object which I call the normal products of phi X and phi of Y times the other operator, okay? And you see that it's a definition which is valid for any phi of Z1, phi of Zn, exactly like that. So in fact, if I have a relation between two objects which is valid for any phi of z1, phi of zn in the expectation value, it means that it's a relation which is valid in terms of operators. So I can define, in fact, this defines a new operator which is the normal order, well, the normal products of phi of x and phi of y. So but dash here as, remember, here I have this. Here I have this times this. And here I have this. But this is a number. Okay, so I define this as the ordinary product of the two operators minus this quantity, which is a number. It's not an operator. It's just a number, a function of two points, the expectation value of the products of the two operators phi of x and phi of y in the free field theory, times the operator identity, because it doesn't cost anything to insert an operator identity here. Okay? So I define a new operator like that, which is the old product minus the identity operator times a function of the position x and y. It's given by your calculation, and here it's just given by the ordinary propagator here. But it's a function. You see? Yes? So
the normal order product here, as we defined it, it should be the same thing as we saw in Q1.
Yeah, so I call it a normal product because it's a product which in some sense is normalized. But yes. Yes.
That goes to zero. If I span phi in terms of creation and
yes.
All the creation operators are on the left. And there's a vacuum in the problem.
You mean here? Yeah, here.
The other equation.
I'm sorry. Here? No, it's not zero because here you have operator phi of z and phi, and if some of the phi are here, they create states which are not annihilated at that state. Okay, so in general, this is non-zero. This operator in general is non-zero. So I call it the normal product. Normal product. Okay. And in fact, for the free theory, the massless, the free theory, it's nothing but the normal order product that you have seen in QFT 1. But here it's defined just in a more abstract way. And so it's a definition which, in fact, goes along in more complicated quantum field theory, in particular in interacting field theory, okay? And you see that this operator now has a very nice properties. It is that this operator is defined when x is different from y, but taken as an operator, the limit when x goes to y of the normal product of phi of x and phi of y exists is well defined. And you can call them it by definition the normal products of phi of x squared. You see? So as an operator, it's perfectly well defined. You see? And as an operator, from this calculation, you see that the normal products of phi squared Okay, as an operator, I call it the normal product of phi squared, so I would prefer to write it as a normal product of phi squared calculated at point x. So this is the operator calculated at point x. And you see that from this definition, phi squared at point x can be written as simply phi of x squared minus phi of x squared times the operator identity. This is infinite, but this as an operator is finite, because in fact, we have seen that this as an operator is ill-defined, but this operation subtracts the divergent part, which is just proportional to the operator 1. You see? So now, let us think a little more. So we have seen that we can define an operator phi squared, but simply we have to subtract the divergent part to define a finite operator. And this operator is finite in the sense that all its matrix elements are finite. Or if you insert it in any correlation function like that, you see, this will be finite as long as the point x doesn't come close to z1, zn. You see? Okay. So now the question is, can we do that for the operator phi 4, which is required if you want to quantize the theory, the interacting theory consistently? And of course, the answer is yes. Simply, you have to work a little bit more. Now you have basically to consider what's happening when you have 4 points and other points. Okay. So I have 4 points, x1 up to x4. And if I am doing that, you see that I have you have 3 kind of diagrams. You have the diagrams where 2 of the phi 4 operator are connected. Then you have a contribution where you have 2 of the phi 4 connected and 2 are connected elsewhere. And you have the contribution where all the x's are connected to the other points. And if you think about it, you see that this will define an operator which will be the normal product of the phi 4 operator at a single point. But you see that now to make the relation between what is phi 4 of x and phi of x squared, the relation is slightly more complicated because in fact it involves this operator, which is phi, the normal product of phi squared, and this operator, which is basically the operator 1. So in fact, you can rewrite this relation. This relation means simply, in fact, that I can write the operator phi 4 of x, which is divergent, as phi squared of x, but this is a divergent number, but I have it twice. It's the square of phi square of x, which is divergent because they have 2 propagators. Now you have a factor 3 because you have 3 ways to contract, to pair 4 points. And then I said this is times the operator 1. So this is a number divergent. This is an operator. Here you have, in the same way, 1 single phi squared of x which is divergence, times the operator, which is the normal, this is phi squared of x, normal, the normal product of phi squared of x. Okay? And you have a factor here, 6, because you have 6 ways to pair 2 points between 6 points. And then you have this contribution, which is by definition, now, the normal product of phi 4 at point x. Okay, so this diagrammatic picture means simply this relation between the operator here, which is singular, it's not well defined, and this operator, which is well defined. Okay? And we have already this relation between phi squared and phi squared. So we know already how to compute phi squared. So from this, we know how to compute this operator. So you see, so this goes along, and you can define many, many operators like that. Okay? So we can define the phi squared. Okay? So now let me just end up. I have only a few minutes left. So let me think about what is going on when I want to compute. Yes?
On more general grounds.
Yes?
How is it that we can have one operator, phi of x, which is well defined, but its square and other higher powers aren't? Because normally, like
It's simply because you have seen that in the functional integral formalism, you have a d phi times an action, s of phi. The phi are not operators, they are random variables. Okay? And the expectation value of products of those random variables define this object, which corresponds to vacuum expectation value of quantum operators. Okay? So we use, in a bit sketchy way, the same notation for operators acting on the hyperspace here and random variables in the functional integral. Okay? And we have seen that those random variables are quite wild objects at short distances. Okay. So this means that they are highly non-trivial distribution function, you see? And if you have a function which has a wild distribution, it may very well that some of its moments are finite and some of its moments are not finite, you see? If you have a Gaussian distribution like that for a random variable, x, if it's Gaussian, all the xk are well defined and finite. But if you have a Gaussian fluctuation with a heavy tail, you may very well have that x1, x2 is finite, but x3, etc., are infinite. And that's precisely what's happening here. The distribution of field configuration in the functional integral is a highly singular probability distribution with heavy tail in all directions, which means that very, very, very few moments of the distribution are well defined. See? So it just reflects in terms of when you think about those objects in terms of operators, those short distance singularity just reflect the fact that in the functional integral, the probability distribution have heavy tails everywhere in configuration space, especially when you look at correlation at short distance between the value of the field at very neighboring points. Okay? Okay, so now let me go back simply to what's happening now when So I've seen that you have a way to define operators which are more complicated operators than just the field operator in field theory. And that's exactly, in fact, it corresponds to what you have been doing by normal order product prescription in quantum field theory one, so in canonical quantization. Yes?
If we take a square of normal product of phi square, like
yes?
It will be a regular well-defined operator or not?
Which operator?
Like phi square, normal.
Yes.
N square.
Yes, it's a well-defined operator. It has a well-defined matrix element defined exactly by the same prescription. So this operator, as an operator, is well-defined because all its matrix element.
No, I'm taking first phi squared, then dots, then square.
Ah. You are expanding of what is the meaning of phi squared times phi squared. Your meaning is,
can you
define the meaning of that? Is this well defined?
Yeah, how is it compared to like phi to the fourth?
And the question is this well defined or do you have to define a normal product of this normal product? So very good question. So perhaps I can discuss what I want to discuss now, which is the operator product expansion, precisely on this example. Okay. So the question, in order whether to show whether this is well defined, what you have to consider is whether I consider phi squared of x, I consider the normal products of phi squared at point y. You see, those are two operators. So this is an operator. This is another operator. And I'm interested in what is happening when x goes to y. You see? Okay. So now let me consider that this operator is inserted into the correlation function like that. You see? What does it mean? It means that I have somewhere a big box where I have all my z's. I'm considering the expectation value of this operator inserted into a phi one. So I have my z's, z1, zn. And somewhere here, I will put it in between in my box. I have, at point x, and at point y, I have a normal product of phi squared and a normal product of phi squared. So it means that somewhere here, I have, and I don't know very well what's going on, I have two operators with two legs. Here I have a phi squared. So here I have a, let me represent the phi of z as a point with one line coming out. Let me represent a phi squared of z normal order as a point x with two legs which comes out of it. You see what I mean? And so I have here 2.6 point 2 point I. And remember, now I want to apply the Vick theorem to see what are all the contractions which contribute to this diagram. And remember, since I am considering the normal products of phi squared, the only rule is that this is forbidden. This is already subtracted by the definition of the normal products of phi squared. You see? So now, if you think about it, you still have, when x goes to y, singular configuration, because you have three configurations. First, you may have a contribution where x and y are contracted, and all the other ones here are the same. You see? Then you may have contraction where one of the field x is contracted to one of the field y, and the other one here goes to the phi of z. And then finally, you have something where here the two fields of phi squared of x are contracted with some of the phi of the z's, and the two fields of phi of z are contracted. Okay, so you see. So this is a very singular object because it's proportional to the product of two propagators. But here, you have just the products of the expectation value of the products of the z's here. See? So in the same way that we have said that in this contribution, this first term gives you 1 times phi of x, phi of y, I can write that this project here. So I'm computing something which is this, phi squared of x, phi squared of y. And this contribution gives me something. It gives me something which is proportional to this function, which is phi of x, phi of y squared times the operator 1, because this doesn't act with this. Here, when x goes to y, you see that this comes to 0. So in fact, this corresponds to the operator, which was the normal product of phi of x and phi of y, times a function which is singular, which is the propagator phi of x, phi of y. Okay? And this remaining contribution, you see, is something that I can call the normal product of the normal product of phi squared of x times the normal product of phi squared of y. You see, this gives these terms, this gives these terms, and this gives this term. You see? And pardon? Yes, yes, that's what I'm going to do because I realize that it's very. I can do that. The front, send it. Okay, and the rear, I go down. So, you see that in terms of operators, now consider that x goes to y. This is very singular. It's a product of two propagators times the operator 1. So I can write in a fancy way that the product of those two operators, phi squared at point x times the normal product of phi squared at point y, is equal to, first, a contribution which is the sum of all those diagrams, which is proportional to x minus y to the power minus 4 times the operator identity with some coefficient c1, which comes from the various combinatory factor. Then I have the contribution of these diagrams, which is the first approximation is some other x minus y. There is only one propagator, so I have x minus y to the power minus 2. And then I have this operator, this normal product of operator, which has a regular limit when x goes to y. So I can write this as a normal product of phi squared of x. And then you will have a few other terms that I won't discuss here. And then you have finally this contribution, which is nothing. There is 1. And then this is the normal product of phi 4 to the point x. You see? So here you have 1. So you see, here you have operators. These are, let me draw them in red. Those are operators. 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 which are local operators. They depend only on what's happening at points local. The coefficient here, you have a factor one if you want, a number, this. These are function of x minus y, you see? And you have a general feature that in fact, that this takes a general form. You have some operator O1 of x. You have some other operator O2 of x, where you have two operators, two quantum operators. You see, here those two operators are the normal products of I squared. And you get that when x goes to y, you get a decomposition according to operators. Here's the operator one, here's the operator phi squared, normal product of phi squared, here's the normal product of phi four. So in fact, you get the sum over operators O3, where the operator O3 is located at the point x. And here you have a function, the coefficient of C of x minus y. And this coefficient, in fact, is different. So it depends on the operator you have here. So it depends on the index, O3. So it depends on the operator 3. Oh, let us assume that, yes, so it's O3. And that depends also of O1 and O2. So these are functions. These are operators. Okay? You see? When you take the products of two quantum operators and at different points, and you see what's happening when they come close together, in general, this is divergent because these coefficients are divergent. But they are given by the sum of local operators times coefficients which may be divergent or convergent or regular when x goes to y. You see? So you see that what you have obtained is that you have obtained an expansion at short distances of the product of two operators. You see? You take the products of two operators, and you try to see how these products, which is singular when x goes to y, expand as a function of the distance, x minus y, when the two operators come close together. And you find that it's given by an expansion in terms of coefficient. And this coefficient is very singular. This coefficient is less singular. The coefficient here is a constant function, so it's not singular, times operators. Here's the operator identity. Here's the operator phi squared. Here's the operator phi four. Okay? So, and so it's an expansion at short distance of the products of operators, which is expressed as a sum of operators times coefficients. So this structure is very general. This is very general. Okay, and it's called the operator, in short, product expansion, or in short, the OPE. This structure, which is in fact very general in quantum theory, was discovered by the physicist Ken Wilson. It tells you basically that, let me rewrite it, that if you have two operators, A of x, B of y, you can rewrite the expansion as a sum over operator C of x times some coefficient. Let us write this A, B, and C because those are operators. Remember, these are operators, times some coefficient C of, and so it depends, in fact, of the C A B of x minus y. So where this is, these are functions which behave like x minus y. And if you think a little bit about it here, in general, this behaves like singular function. And the coefficient which appears here, here you have an x minus y minus 4, because remember, phi is dimension 1, so phi square has dimension 2. Phi square has dimension 2. The operator 1 has dimension 0. So in fact, this coefficient is minus the dimension of the operator. So in fact, the coefficient in the operator product expansion of x minus y of the product between, when you have the coefficient between the operator A, B, and C, behaves simply as some power of x minus y, where you have the dimension of the operator C minus the dimension of the operator A minus the dimension of the operator B. So this operator product expansion, in fact, in the series in terms of operator, coming from the operator which has the smallest dimension to the operator which has the highest dimension. Because here, the dimension of phi is 1, remember. So the dimension of phi squared is 2, and the dimension of phi 4 is 4. So you go first from the dimension 0 to dimension 2 to dimension 4 operators, etc., etc. And in fact, this structure goes on. Okay? And this, to end up with, I will end up this and I will conclude tomorrow. Yes? I'm sorry? Yes. It's term which corresponds to the fact that this is a function of x minus y. So when you expand, you make this expansion. You have a higher. This is regular in x and y. So in fact, you can add derivative of that. So in fact, this there is a term here which has not written, which corresponds to a new operator, which is the square the derivative of the gradient of phi squared. So there is an operator that I omitted for simplicity, which is another operator with dimension 4, which involves two field phi and two derivatives with respect to the dimension. So it has also a dimension, and I have been quite sketchy, so I have omitted it. But in fact, in this operator product expansion of this object, there is another operator which has dimension 4, which is defined to the 4. You see? So what you must just keep in mind from this calculation is that you can define the composite operator by this procedure of normal products. And moreover, when you look at how products of such composite operator behaves at short distances, there is an expansion in terms of local operators themselves. So the structure of the divergences of the short distance singularities in any quantum field theory is encoded into the local operator of the theory. So short distance singularities encoded into local operators. You don't have something bubbling out which is non-local in a quantum theory out of the theory which is defined from local operator. You see? And that's one of the reasons why renormalization products works. Despite the fact that you have short distance singularity or high energy divergences, the divergences are still encoded into local operators. So you can renormalize the theory. Okay, thank you.